Welcome to Current State. I'm your host, Mickey Hurton, filling in for Mark Bayshore. Hey, it's Live Music Friday, and let's kick things off with a song from Class and Jazz. Our live music guests this week are Oleg Bezuglov and Natalia Bezuglova. Together, they're known as Class and Jazz. Natalia, what was the name of that song?
Oh, that was Peace in a Blues Style by Russian composer in a jazz style, Igor Frolov.
Oh, beautiful rendition. Thanks so much. Hey, very good. We look forward to hearing more from both of you later on in the show.
Thank you.
But first, we have Nick Greaser, entering his fifth season as general manager of the Lansing Lugnuts.
Morning.
Nick, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for the entertainment.
Yeah, it's,
you didn't have to do that for me.
You're not at the stadium today.
Right.
Hey, listen, you just ended the season. Can you give us a quick rundown? How did it go?
Sure. Yeah, we had one of those years that was a bit up and down. We came out of the gate really strong from a on the field perspective, and kind of teetered out towards the end, but that's kind of the nature of the business with minor league baseball. You know, the guys are trying to get promoted. Mm-hmm. So we lost a lot of our good players about middle of the season, but we ended about 500, just missed the playoffs. But overall, it was a good year.
Isn't that the oddity of it, though, that you have the better you do, almost the worse you do?
Yeah, it really, and that's, they split the minor leagues in half mm-hmm. for that very reason. And it's very common to see teams win the first half and then be in dead last in the second half, because that very same thing happens. All the guys get promoted, and then you have a whole different team the second half, which we got a new crop of guys at the end of the season that, you know, it's going to be our team next year. So we, you know, it's kind of how the business goes.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not sure that people realize how many major league players have come through the Lansing Lugnuts organization. I was surprised.
Yeah, you know, last count I had was 119 former Lugnuts have at least made one major league start. And then over the last 4 or 5 years, there's been a whole new crop of players that have gone up through the, you know, we've been a Blue Jays affiliate for 12 years now, that have come up through the Blue Jays system that, you know, are starting to become everyday names. Guys like Noah Syndergaard. You know, mm-hmm. he was a lug nut and an all-star for us in 2012. Kevin Pillar, who's an outfielder for Blue Jays. So there's a lot of names out there now. And then, of course, some of our most famous alumni are Carlos Beltran,
sure.
Carlos Zambrano, guys from back when we were a Cubs affiliate. But, you know, the funny thing about it is we could have a lot of major leaguers on our team, but you're never going to know it for 3 or 4 years down the road.
You have to keep a list.
Yeah.
Any particularly hot prospect this year? Somebody who looks like they've got it?
You know, there was a guy, a pitcher that was with us at the first part of the season, Sean Reed Foley, John Harris, both pitchers that have been pretty big prospects. But, you know, I try not to back myself into a corner too much with that because I am not a baseball scout, so I found myself to be wrong more than I'm right with trying to project who's going to make it up there or not. But I'm surprised a lot, both good and bad, I guess. So, but yeah, you know, that's, you know, through our league, we've had, I mean, Albert Pujols played in this league, you know, Prince
right,
Fielder.
Right.
I mean, there's been a lot of big names of Jake Mauer. I mean, Mike Trout. I mean, there's been a lot of big names that have come through our league that, again, you just don't really know till down the road.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the fan experience this year? I mean, there was an awful lot. Anyone who went to the stadium last year and came back there goes, what happened here? I think the outfield has changed the whole nature of the thing, but the whole fan experience, good year?
Yeah, great year. And that's really what the experience of the ballpark is about, is more about, you know, the entertainment and the fan side of it. Very few of our fans, you know, really come for the baseball, as weird as that sounds. They come for a night out with their family. They come for something to do. So it's shocking how many people come and, you know, can leave the ballpark and not name one player on our team.
Or some of them can't tell you who won the game.
Yeah. So, you know,
but they can tell you that big lug.
Exactly.
Walked through the stadium and shook their hand.
Yeah, exactly. And so we really cater to that. We try to make it an entertaining night for whether you're a baseball fan or not. And a big part of that has been, you know, all the renovations that we've done to the stadium over the last 2 years, really. You know, and there's been a bunch of changes. If you haven't been to the stadium in a couple of years, it's changed dramatically. The most notable is the outfield building, which where we have 84 apartment buildings just up past the outfield wall. Nothing like it in the country, major league or minor league, where residents are actually living inside of the stadium. So it's a pretty cool concept. They're literally
inmates,
20 feet past the wall.
They can't escape.
Yeah, it's literally 20 feet past the outfield wall. And you know, they were very upfront about some of the dynamics of living at the ballpark. I mean, obviously, we're pretty active. We're loud and bright. We clean at night. Lights stay on late. So I think the tenants that live there have had a really good experience over the last about 4 months now. I think they've been living there. But not only that, we did a lot of things at the current stadium. We upgraded. You know, one of the biggest impacts the average fan is we have 3 new scoreboards. State-of-the-art scoreboards that have come in. Our main board has doubled in size. We've got a suite level facade board that's, you know, and then a right field board as well. And it's just all for the fan experience. We've added venues. We've added bars. We've added, you know, little things, a new playground area. We've added things like we created the Michigan Baseball Hall of Fame that lives out in the outfield concourse. So everything we did as part of the renovations, one, there were some structural kind of boring things that we had to do to keep the stadium operational. But then everything that we could focus on that we wanted to make sure it impacted the fans in a positive way. And I'm extremely happy with it. I think the fans that have come out over the last year have really seen that and have changed their experience at the ballpark.
You know, it really was time to reinvest in the stadium. I mean, it always looks good. But, I mean, isn't it almost 20 years old?
We just finished our 21st season, believe it or not.
And so, yeah, and then I guess not a lot had been done. And a lot of the things that happened, I mean, the outfield is obvious, but the things in the back, you know, behind the scenes.
Well, we are a city-owned facility. So the city of Lansing does own the ballpark. And, you know, we've got a great relationship with the city, with the mayor's office. The mayor's a big supporter of ours. And we really had the vision that we didn't want to wait till the ballpark started to fall apart. You know, it's so much easier to stay ahead of it. So for the last 20 years, there'd been some modest renovations, but nothing significant. So, yeah, we did a lot of boring things. The roof was in need of repair. You know, we had to fix some HVAC and some plumbing and some electrical and some concrete work and things like that that really don't make the headlines, but that are important to keep the ballpark, you know, presentable when people walk in. It's the things they don't even realize. So, the city's been a great partner. They have really invested a lot of time and energy into the ballpark, and I think it really shows. And for a 21-year-old ballpark, it looks brand new.
Yeah, it really does. I think that would surprise people. You know, it's funny because it's minor league baseball is one of the real selling points in the area. When you talk about the economic development officials and just people in general, it changes the nature of a community like Lansing having something like this, because it goes from April up through September.
Yep, exactly. It's about 5.5 month season. And, you know, that's the true reason why the ballpark was originally built 21, 22 years ago, was to really revitalize downtown. You know, if you're familiar with the area, it was not a real, you know, good place of town to go down and visit with your family.
It was colorful, I think, is the most most polite way to describe it.
Yeah, and former Mayor David Hollister and our owner and only owner, Tom Dixon, really had a vision to build the ballpark in that area with the goal of, you know, businesses booming around it and bringing people downtown in a safe environment. And 21 years later, it's still the same vision, and it's still continuing to develop, and even so much so with the outfield development. The Gillespie Group is, you know, they really own the second, third, and fourth floor, which is where the tenants are living. So it's a good public-private partnership. The city owns the ground floor, and Gillespie owns the top three. So
I mean, it's a condominium, but one of the oddest condominiums you can think of.
It was an interesting dynamic. You know, probably not horribly uncommon in large cities, but in Lansing, you know, kind of the public-private condo air rights concept was we learned a lot. You know, things like where those are. Our ceiling end and their floor begin, but they've been great partners as well. We talk pretty regularly, and we try to make sure that you know, we're good partners and think about the residents that are living there when we're doing things. So it's been fun. It's been interesting. We've had a lot of national response out of it. You know, people are kind of curious about how do you really do this and how does this happen. So. Not sure I wanted to be the guinea pig for all that, but in hindsight, I'm glad we were.
Well, when you talk with Pat Gillespie, he says his only regret in this project was that he didn't put it on another floor.
You know, I've heard him say that as well, because they sold out extremely quick. It's been occupied since the grand opening, which I believe was around May. So, it's been well received.
Now, have you had visitors from all over the country to come and look at this?
We've had some visitors. I've had a lot of phone calls. And it got a lot of national media when we announced it. And, you know, the baseball world, there's 160 minor league teams, 30 major league teams. So out of the 200-ish teams, we're all pretty close. So we do a lot of conferences and things together. And, yeah, it's been the talk of a lot of the events I go to is, you know, how did this work? How did you do this? And what's the response? So I expect to see this happening down the road in other markets.
Well, I think the Gillespie Group sees that as an opportunity. I mean, I've done, you know, some stories about this, and he says that he thinks he can be building this in other places, which would sort of be cool. We'd be like the father of outfield housing.
Well, Pat's the guy to do it. He's a trendsetter. He's a visionary, and he has great ideas. And sometimes you kind of think they might be a little crazy, and then few months later, they're happening. So, you know, my hat's off to him. He's doing a lot of good things in downtown Lansing, in the Lansing area, and he's a great partner to work with.
You know, it's interesting. You say you talk with other minor league clubs and that. Is the Lansing experience with minor league baseball pretty much replicated in other communities?
Conceptually, yes. We obviously do things a little bit, everybody operates a little bit differently, but the concept, I believe, is the same. It's not so much focused on baseball. It's more about entertainment. You know, for example, we're 53% female on our attendance, which some people are surprised by that, because we're, you know, and we, when we market our events and market our, you know, things that are happening at the ballpark, we always try to talk to the moms, because we find that they're the ones that are organizing what the family's doing over the weekend.
Right.
So a lot of our advertising is geared towards females, which at the major league level, that's a little bit different. You know, they're advertising to the baseball fanatics, where we're really talking about, hey, You know, we're competing with the movies more than anything. We're not competing with other sports entities or other, you know, Michigan State football, basketball, baseball, whatever. We're fighting with the movies and dinner and a night out with your family. So, yeah.
Well, you go both ways. I mean, because you see the people. I mean, when I go there, I'm not really interested. I don't need another T-shirt or a hot dog shot at me. But I do like watching the game.
Oh, of course. I don't want to undermine that whatsoever.
But I'm saying you can go both ways.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, our major league affiliate is Toronto Blue Jays, which this isn't really a Blue Jays market. So that's a little bit to our disadvantage. For example, the West Michigan Whitecaps, they're a Tigers affiliate. They're in Michigan,
yeah.
Mostly a Tigers fan base. So that certainly helps them. I don't think the Blue Jays affiliate hurts us, but it certainly doesn't help us the way that a Tigers affiliation or our local market or our local team would. But that's all, you know, that's all really somewhat irrelevant. It's still more about coming out to the ballpark and having a good night.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I think that people ought to recognize is that the Lansing Lugnuts are, you know, a real business in town. It's not just the players on the field.
Yeah.
But when you look at your website and you just talk to people, I mean, you have a fairly good economic, well, not, you know, an economic impact on the area. What do you have for, what kind of staff?
We are about 350 staff members when we're at full operation in the middle of the season. We are a seasonal operation, so in the off season we're 20 to 25 full-time staff. And we've been gotten much more active in doing events at the ballpark. For example, tonight is Beer Fest at the ballpark.
Right,
so we're converting the ballpark into a beer tasting event, where we'll have about 45 breweries on the actual playing surface of the field, and people can come down, you buy a ticket and you go, and it's a beer sampling event. This will be our
country concert.
Yeah.
About a month ago.
Yep.
Wasn't it?
Taste of Country, but it was back in June. We've been trying to get more active in concerts. You know, we're replacing our field on Monday, so we actually have been doing miniature golf all week. We mowed
a
miniature golf course into the field. We mowed 18 holes, and in 3 nights we've had close to 1,000 people play it already. So it's taking place tonight during the Beer Fest, and then it'll be on Saturday and Sunday, noon to 5, and it's just $5. So you can come play a round of golf. It's very unique. You know, we just are always trying to think of ways to provide entertainment options for downtown and mid-Michigan area, and this was just one of those opportunities that we had with replacing the field. We could really tear it up a little bit this last week. It didn't matter because we're replacing the whole surface.
Why is that?
It's time. Our sod is about 11 years old. The average baseball field about every 5 to 7 years should be replaced, so we're a little behind. Michigan State Turf Program is actually growing our sod right now. So here in the next couple of weeks, it'll be cut up and brought over, and we'll have a brand new playing surface for next year.
You're going to sell pieces of the old sod to the real Lugnut diehards?
You know, we thought about it. I don't think we're going to, but you're not the first one that's asked, yeah.
So what's coming up next year? I mean, what should we look forward to?
Sure, we're actually working through our 2017 schedule right now. We'll announce that within the next month. But we'll have a lot of our staple, you know, our LAFCU fireworks nights are some of our biggest nights, and those are kind of the fan favorites. You know, we do 15 to 20 of those every year. We always have the 4th of July, which we do have that game again. So we're putting together our promotional schedule. I'm sure we'll have some fun things that we're going to do. You know, one thing we've been talking about is a pet-friendly night every night of the week, or one night of the week every week. So Monday nights are going to be, I think we're going to call it the dog days of summer, so you can bring your dog every Monday night. So that's just one of the silly things we do.
Would you keep the dogs right there in the seats?
They can go anywhere they want. Yeah, we've done it before on one night a year, but I think we're just going to open it up to be every Monday. So that's just one small example of some things that we try to do. You know, Wednesdays are our winning Wednesdays. If the Lugnuts win, your ticket gets exchanged for another game. Our Labatt Thursday Thursdays are always popular. So every night of the week, there's something different going on, and then we'll put some other fun promotions around it.
Well, what about players? I mean, that's always the trickier part, isn't it? I mean, you can control what, you know, dog nights and things like that. But what about the, you know?
Yeah, it's as a general manager, people often think that I'm like a major league general manager, where I'm in the war room on draft day and I'm I'm making the calls as far as our 5-man starting pitching rotation and the starting lineup. That is the
season was on you,
right? That's at the minor league level. Unfortunately, fortunately, that's not the way it works. I could not run that side of the business, but no, really, I run the operation. I run the facility. Affiliated baseball, that the Toronto Blue Jays and their staff really make all those baseball decisions. We really just house them, make them comfortable, and do all the fun, goofy stuff around them.
But that's sort of odd, isn't it? I mean, so you really don't know what you're going to be putting on the field.
Correct.
Until March, maybe the end of March?
Oh, yeah, about a week prior to opening days when I find out the roster. We'll have an estimate. Okay, a funny example is if you ever come and buy one of our programs, mm-hmm. we have to print our programs, you know, lead times and things, about 3 weeks before the season starts. we're taking a guess that there are players that are on our roster at opening day. So we're usually about 75% right. And then, you know, it changes so often throughout the year. People are always a little upset. They come in, they read our program and say, well, this guy's not even on the team. Well, he was here 2 weeks ago. He's not now. He might be here another 2 weeks. So, but yeah, I don't know really who's coming and who's going. I usually find out about an hour before the players do if they're coming in or leaving. So it's just how the operation works. Again, for me, I actually prefer it that way. I like just to be able to work with our partners in the community and not have to worry about the sports side of it, but yet still have that little bit of sports, feel. So I kind of get that itch satisfied, I guess. But, it's a great partnership with everybody the way it works. It's a lot of fun.
Well, it's a great organization. We look forward to next year. I want to thank Nick Grietza for being here with us, general manager of the Lansing Lugnuts. And thank you so much.
Thanks
we'll see you
me.
On the field next year.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Well, that was Class in Jazz. Oh, like that one sounded pretty familiar.
There was Jerome Skiern's famous song, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, arranged by me for our ensemble a while ago.
Wonderful arrangement. We look forward to hearing more from Class in Jazz later in the hour. But first, on Sunday, some 350 communities across the U.S. will take part in a national show of unity against gun violence. In New York City, performers like Jackson Browne, Roseanne Cash, Eddie Vedder will headline a concert across America to end gun violence. And in Lansing, a church is joining in that effort. The concert at the Unitarian Universalist Church features several local artists, including a group of MSU theater students. Current State's Kevin Lavery spoke with several people involved with the concert. He first spoke with Linda Brundage, the executive director of the Michigan Coalition to Prevent Gun Violence, who explained the significance of the concert date.
September 25th is a nationally designated date to remember murder victims. So when we joined in, there were 40-some. This morning, when I looked at the computer, there were 350 all across the country, and they're all on that day. So it really is quite an event. It's really been a great thing for us to have Rob from the Department of Theater reach out to us, and serendipitously, he's doing a play that has a gun violence focus. And so it was really an excellent fit for us to work together.
Rob, tell me about the theater department's production of Punk Rock.
I really believe it's a psychological study of how someone or a group of people can devolve based on the pressure that they're under. And I think that that demographic, that age range of students 16 through 25, really are under so much pressure and not really given the coping skills to deal with that. And I think this play examines how people can unravel. And what's interesting about it, in the gun violence in the play, you are looking throughout the play because you know sort of from the premise or the message from the play that something's going to happen. And any one of those students could at any point, you know, they are a ticking time bomb. So watching this play, you're examining, well, that person could be the shooter, or that person could be. So I think that all of those things give us a look into the psychology of something and how it can happen and how society can let it happen.
Are there any external forces in the play that are trying to work on behalf of the main characters? Any positive intervention, or are they left to their own devices?
In the play, they're left to their own devices. They are in sort of an abandoned upper library in the school. This is their cocoon, and in there is bullying. There is just awful, awful interactions that we witness as an audience. So the hope that is there is very minor and very bleak, and I think also representative of what some of that generation might feel at the time, the hopelessness, the pressure to succeed without the coping skills.
I'm Jeanette Angelini. I play Sissy in Punk Rock.
I'm Evan Hodek, and I play Nicholas in Punk Rock.
I'm Grant Cleveland, and I play Chadwick in Punk Rock.
Jeanette, what is Punk Rock really all about?
Punk Rock is about students who are going to like a British boarding school type of deal. They are joined together in this library, and they struggle with just the angst and the pressure of their everyday lives and how each and every one of them deals with that and their relationships to one another. And the ending kind of ties into the whole gun violence thing because it's pushing someone to the brink of what they're going through and not being sensitive to someone's feelings and emotions as much as possible. And that leads them to do drastic things.
So it sounds like there's not one central plot, but a myriad of subplots involving multiple different characters. Is that a good way of describing that, Evan?
Yeah, the students that are involved in the show are all kind of, they're all going to the same school together, and their friends are not really friends. They're more of, you know, just people going through the same thing. Each has their own separate little plot, but they all kind of interweave together into the myriad of things that end up taking the show to the places that it goes.
Grant, tell me about Chadwick and what he's all about.
Chadwick is kind of a nerdy guy who gets bullied a lot, which pushes other characters to the brink. It ties in themes of sexuality and, obviously bullying and gun violence, and it all comes back together for a really explosive, raw ending. And Chadwick really gets caught up in the middle of things, I'd say.
I'm wondering, Jeanette, if people will, you know, we live in a time and a place where gun violence pervades the news just about every single day. Why go see a production if we're almost, at least in an ancillary way, living it every day through the news?
It'll be shocking for everyone, and I think the people who have seen it thus far, like people in the crew or people who have come to see rehearsals, have always left feeling almost a little uneasy, but that's kind of what we wanted to do. We didn't want something to, you know, put people over the edge, but we didn't want it to be something that we weren't working hard towards. But I mean, I agree, like it's always in the news and it's always something that we have to be conscious of. But in a production like this, it's done a little differently, but I think the message still rings true amongst, even if we see it every day, it's just always a reminder of what's going on in the world.
Do you guys have personal feelings, or dare I even say personal connections in some way, personal experience, with gun violence, or at least your reflections on the state of that epidemic in our country today?
Well, one of the things we did in order to start preparing for these roles is we had the Coalition to End Gun Violence come and do a little seminar with us at the very beginning of our rehearsal process, and they showed us a documentary that focused on the survivors and the family of people who were killed in related gun violence, and it was a constant bombardment of just story after story after story of all these people whose lives were tragically ended by use of guns and related incidents. So afterwards, we were all really taken aback by how, you know, how often it happens and how serious it is, even though we see it all the time in the news. So it was a very humbling moment to figure that out and kind of realize the gravity of what subject matter we were dealing with.
Jeanette Angelini, Evan Hodeck, and Grant Cleveland, three members of the production Punk Rock that's being put forth by the MSU Department of Theater. I'm wondering if you guys feel as actors if this production changes you personally in some way. Are you left a little bit differently at the end of it each time?
I think most definitely you learn something new from every show that you do, this one especially. I think a lot of research has to be done when you're doing a show like this. So, I mean, I know I personally researched a lot of stories about Columbine and seeing like diary entries and reading firsthand accounts and reading what these guys were like and how they were pushed to do something so absurd and intense. So it leaves me more educated on what's going on and more cognizant of our world and the traumas that happen, especially watching that gun violence video and talking to other people and just working with the cast so closely. It was a great learning experience.
Yeah, like Jeanette said, every show that you do, you learn something new and you take away something, a little extra every time. This one especially, just because the cast is so small and because the subject matter is so intense, you know, I think we're all, you know, because we're all thrown into the middle of it and you know, being forced to live out this horrifying storyline is something that we're definitely never going to forget, and we're always going to remember how much work and effort went into making such a profound statement about this issue.
Yeah, the show is definitely intimate and close, and I've learned a lot through this whole process. It's pretty heavy subject matter, so it got hard at some points, but you know, the cast and crew are some of my best friends, and I wouldn't want to do it with anyone else.
Jeanette Angelini, Grant Cleveland, and Evan Hodeck are cast members in the production of Punk Rock that is being performed by the MSU Department of Theater. I appreciate your time. Thanks, Jeanette.
Thank you so much.
Evan, thank you.
Thank you.
Grant, thanks so much.
Thank you.
There is particular legislation that has been introduced in Michigan, which Punk Rock really speaks directly to. It's called Senate Bill 442. It has passed judiciary, and the Senate is now on the Senate floor. If we get Senate Bill 442, that will allow guns on campus, guns in classrooms, guns in dormitories, guns in professors' offices, public schools, daycares, smaller auditoriums, bars. So I think it's just superb timing to be working with the students of Punk Rock and, you know, by extension, getting that message out to the students here, and perhaps then they can help us when that comes to the floor.
I'm talking with Linda Brundage, who is the executive director of the Michigan Coalition to Prevent Gun Violence, and also with Rob Rosnowski, theater professor in the MSU Department of Theater. Linda, what type of pushback do you routinely hear from the pro-gun lobby? I'm sure you're used to hearing the rhetoric of people saying we have a constitutionally protected right.
Well, regarding the bill that I just discussed, Senate Bill 442, senators brought in a person who has been totally discredited by any number of really fine researchers. And his premise really is we should not have gun-free zones, that those are targets. Well, there's zero research to support that notion. Gun violence happens where there are guns. So that's one of the kinds of pushbacks.
And probably pushback from people who say, I'm going to protect myself, I'm going to protect my family and my property. It's difficult to convince that mindset otherwise, isn't it?
Very, very. And then again, there's very little research that the good guy with the gun does much of anything. There's often collateral damage when our trained police officers appropriately try to intervene. And they have lots and lots of training. To get a CPL in Michigan, you have 8 hours of gun training. Not enough, in my opinion. And there's just too much that can go wrong, particularly with guns in schools. I mean, at universities, we encourage kids to debate fervently their position. Well, what happens to the question of debate when one or two people on one side have a pistol on their hip?
Linda, tell me about the concert that's being performed Sunday at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Lansing. Is it a fundraiser? Is it a ticketed event? Is there a monetary gain for people in the coalition to help prevent gun violence?
There may be. We're selling tickets, $10 a person, a family for $25, or a donation. And if you don't have any money, come anyway. The purpose is not to raise funds. It's to use music and theater to raise the questions around gun violence. So it's yet another way to get the community talking. And a big piece of this effort is voter registration. What's going to change the question, I think, state and nationally, is if we get everyone out to vote and we get people thinking about gun violence as one of the things to take into consideration as you evaluate a candidate.
Linda Brundage is the executive director of the Michigan Coalition to Prevent Gun Violence, and Rob Rosnowski is the director of the production Punk Rock, which is being performed at the MSU Department of Theater. Some cast members from Punk Rock will also be involved in the Concert Across America, which is being held at the Unitarian Universalist Church on South Pennsylvania Avenue in Lansing on Sunday, part of a nationwide effort to raise awareness about gun violence. Linda and Rob, thank you so much for your time and best of luck.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. I'm Mickey Hurton. At this hour, we've been enjoying the classical music of class and jazz with Natalia Bezuglova and on the piano and Oleg Bezuglov on the violin. They're a married couple, originally from Russia, and both of them are in the MSU doctoral program. And as their name implies, their music combines elements of classical music and jazz. You can see Class and Jazz in concert on October 16th at the Central Methodist Church in Lansing. Oleg, Natalia, welcome to Current State.
Hello, good morning. Thank you for having us.
Oh, you play so wonderfully. Hey, we often ask our Music Friday guests to tell us about their earliest days. You know, what sort of music you listened to growing up, and were your families musical, and when did you learn to play? But first, how did you guys meet?
Well, maybe I will go first. We met in the music school, not surprisingly, you know, being a musician's professional trade and for music since very young age. I was in the special school before I entered the conservatory in Russia, and I was already in the program when Natalia joined my class, the music history class. So she entered the room, and that's sort of how it all started.
You heard music.
Yeah.
And then what? And yours? Your story?
My story, I finished my music school, which takes usually about 7 years in Russia. And then I started thinking of doing something after that. And then I found this special classes, like whatever we have right now for the Juilliard School, like special music school before college level. So that's what was that. And then I came to music history class, and then I've seen this like cute looking guy. I still think that.
That probably helped while you were on tour.
Oh yeah.
Did you are you from a musical family?
No. My father is a journalist, radio station actually, a journalist.
We like that.
So thank you for having me again. I have some experience being on radio, so it's fun. I know that for sure. Yeah, and I started when I was maybe like 10. I mean, started coming for the programs. So and my mom, she's a doctor in many ways. Mm-hmm. Right now, let's put it that way. She's an astrologist and she's a messagist. She's a very profound person, very important person in my life, but none of them are musicians, though all of them are singing. And my brother too, he's a sculptor, pretty famous in Russia, majoring in ice and sand sculpturing. Oh. And he's actually right now in United States doing a festival. Yeah, so all of the family are not, they're not professional musicians, but all into music very much.
How about you, Oleg? Your family musical?
No, not technically. My father is a software engineer, and my mom is a professor of biology in the university. Like Natalia said, my parents, like hers, they were always very supportive of our chosen trade of even when we decided to leave Russia to come to United States, which was a hard decision for us, and you can imagine how hard it was for them to accept that. But they were very understanding about that choice of ours, and they came to visit us many times already.
What brought you to the U.S.? I mean, it sounds like you had, you know, good careers going in Russia.
We did. And we actually graduated from our schools. We completed all the complete course of study in our country. We graduated from the conservatory. Then we graduated from the postgraduate program in chamber music. We won an international competition. We were participating in the festivals. We actually organized our own festival, which we had two times before we left. So everything seemed to be going fine, but then I got this offer from my current professor Dmitry Berlinsky, who invited me over to MSU right away to start a doctorate program in violin performance with him. And this was an opportunity that I just couldn't pass because of his international fame. And I'm so glad that I didn't, because I learned so much from him. And then Natalia entered her program in piano performance with Professor Moriarty here, and she's also close to graduation at this point, as well as me. We both doctorate students in the final stages.
It's an interesting combination, though, classical and jazz, or am I wrong? Do they overlap in ways we don't think about?
Oh, you know, this is very interesting topic, actually, because people don't usually think about classical composers such as like Shostakovich and Ravel. Mm-hmm. Doing jazz style, but they did. So it comes back to 1920s.
Are you going to be playing another song for us? I believe you have something.
Oh, yeah.
Well, get over to that piano.
Oh, I thought to treat our audience today's morning with a piece everybody knows. Let me see if you can recognize it.
All right.
that is a very famous piece, and everybody knows it as Für Elise by Ludwig van Beethoven. And now I want to illustrate what Russian jazz composer Georgi Firtych treated this piece on his own.
Of that song.
That's right. Classical music in a jazz style. That's what they call it.
Well, that was great. Hey, let's talk about your live performance. You have a show coming up at the United Methodist Church called Apparis. Now, tell us, what are you planning?
Well, this is another project of ours, which is not technically, it's our classical project. It consists of all French music for violin and piano. We're going to play Frank Sinatra, César Frank Sinatra, several selected preludes by Debussy, original written by for piano, but arranged for violin and piano, not by me, by different people. And we're going to play Ravel's Tzigane. And our concept or idea, general idea behind this program is to not only to play the French music, but also play it on the French instrument that I have. I'm fortunate to have the French violin made by Pietro and Ippolito Silvestri in 1837 and in Lyon, in the city of Lyon. And I also recently acquired a violin bow made by François Varenne in 1886. And this bow was made in Paris, and it's truly unbelievable. It's true masterpiece. I enjoy every moment that I spend with it. And this project we do as part of our ongoing fundraising project to gather donations for this poor purchase, which was quite expensive. Mm-hmm. It's priced more than $12,000. And so far we played two of them, two concerts in two churches. It went very well over the summer. We're very happy about it. People were very happy in the audience about it. And the whole idea to play the French music on the French instruments, which we're not French people, though, but, you know, it's a lot of French in the program.
Yes. Well, that's just a reminder. That's a concert is Sunday, October 16th at the United Methodist Church in Lansing. And it's the concert is Apparis. Along with your performance classes here, you have other outlets for your music, don't you, Natalia? Do you teach and you play at the Mount Hope United Methodist Church?
Oh, yeah. I did have this rare opportunity to work at the church because, as you know, we are, as Russians, we are Orthodox Christians, and there is not much music in our churches, which is regretfully, I think, this is very my personal opinion, because lots of music is going on here, and the entire culture of classical music raised on music in churches. And when I came here, first time in my life, I got a chance to study organ and play the real organ.
A big pipe organ?
The first organ was a big pipe organ. Now I play electronic organ, but the sound is written from the real organ. So it's sounding really gorgeously. And I'm very thankful for that. Absolutely new vision and new school in my life.
And Oleg, you work with the Flint Institute of Music, and you're playing with several orchestras?
Yes, I do teach in Flint. It's a wonderful institution, wonderful program in there. love my students. For about 2 years, I already teach in there. And I also play in about 6 orchestras here in Michigan State. I'm contracted member of Kalamazoo, Battle Creek, Midland, Flint Symphony, Traverse City, Muskegon, and yeah.
You better have a good calendar with all of that.
I know, it's a lot of driving around, but.
All right. Hey, well, listen, thank you so much for joining us today. You're going to play us out with a final song. Our Live Music Friday guests have been the duo Class and Jazz with Oleg Bezuglov and on the violin and Natalia Bezuglova on the piano. They're playing us out today with Chattanooga Choo Choo.